ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Pretty much everything you opened or used today. Couches you sat on during your break, the clothes you're wearing right now, chances are they were shipped to Australia. Chances are very high they were shipped to Australia. Shipping's a multi-billion dollar industry, and for Australia, of course, it's our lifeline for getting goods in and out of the country. We're an island nation, and the only way pretty much of getting stuff here, short of air freight, which is a pretty small percentage of it, is the only way we get stuff. How does it all work? How's it changed over the years? And what's the future and how fragile is it? All issues, there are plenty of others too, you might have questions about it. Let's try and figure it out. The business of shipping. Jason Williams is an international freight expert and a director at Willship. Now, Willship's a specialised international freight forwarder and customs brokerage known for their international freight shipping services. He's worked with major international players navigating the complexities of international supply chains for over 30 years. And he joins us to talk about the world of shipping. Jason, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
G'day, Phil. How are you, mate?
Very well. I'm so looking forward to this conversation. Every time I see a massive container ship, I think, gee, you know. For example, you know, an ordinary big container ship.
Yes, yeah.
If it had a shipment of fridges, say 420-litre fridges, which is a normal household fridge.
Yeah.
How many fridges could you fit in a container? Just one. Just one container.
Look, they can't lie down because of the gases in them, so they've got to stand up.
Yeah.
And I did have a little look at this before we went on air, and my calculation is in a 20-foot container, I think you'd get 24, and in a 40-foot container, you get 48.
50. So say let's say 50 fridges in a long container, 40-foot container.
Yeah. Yeah.
How many containers can an average container ship carry?
I don't know. I think these days you can't really talk about an average container ship, but I'll talk about I'll go through the whole lot of it if you want. But from essentially China to Australia, we're working with vessels that hold up to about 10,000 containers.
10,000?
Yeah.
So hang on. So that's 50,000. That's 500,000 fridges.
If you want to look at fridges like that,
If it was just all fridges.
Yeah, correct.
500,000 fridges in one ship. I mean, it gives you a sense of the size of it, though, doesn't it?
They're crazy. I actually had a look today, and so the container ships that come to Australia, as I just said, like the biggest ones have 10,000 containers on them. The vessels that run between China and Europe can hold about 24,000 containers.
Wow.
So if we have a think about it, the Titanic was about 270 metres long.
Yeah.
The smaller vessels coming to Australia, 366 metres, and the big mothers running around from China to Europe and the USA are about 400 metres long, and they're twice as wide as the Titanic.
We did a show some years back, which was really interesting because we said, you know, the world fights about everything. We can't even agree on anything. Certainly, you know, we can't agree on world peace. Let's not even go there. But the one thing, remarkably, the world agreed upon in rapid fire time, surprisingly, was the length. When containerization was an issue, because after all, before containerization, the docks were all full of, you know, blokes, it was blokes, loading stuff by hand. Containerization Absolutely. Comes along and big cranes load things on. It made you know, shipping cheaper and more efficient and made countries wealthier. But the thing is, you had to agree on the size of the container. And surprisingly, the whole world agreed on the size of the container, the little one and the big one, because there are only two, aren't there? Very rapidly.
There is a few more in play. Australia only does essentially two. So they do a 20-foot container, which is obviously 20 foot or 6 metres long.
It's actually not 20 feet, though, is it? It's something like 19 and 3/4 inches.
Inside it is. Yeah. Externally it is 20 foot. Yeah. And then there's a 40 foot, but they also do a 40 foot high cube, which is a foot taller than normal.
Mm-hmm.
But into the other trade lanes, they do a 45 foot container. And we don't have them come to Australia as yet, but I'm sure they'll come at some point. And obviously for big bulky goods that don't fit inside the standard, you know, steel-sided containers, we have what they call flat racks, which means that they're essentially just the size of a container with no sides on them, and you just put things on top of them and lash them down and get them surveyed to make sure they're not going to come off.
10,000 metal boxes on the border. You see, when you look at a container ship, you see them all stacked up on deck, but there's masses of more of them below underneath, aren't there? Yeah,
absolutely.
How long does it take to unload one?
Australia's pretty slow at it, to be fair. What you find is a ship isn't going to load every single container in one port and then go to the next port and unload every single container. So they will, let's say between China and Australia, they'll sweep down 3 to 4 ports in China and then roll around to Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne, and possibly Fremantle. So what they're doing at those points, they're unloading and onloading containers at every different point. So the manifest for the vessels obviously must be done really well, because you might have a container for Brisbane that's on top of a container for Sydney, but the vessel goes to Sydney first. So they have to be really clear about that. But they usually are in port for maybe up to 2 days, depending on how much cargo they've got to come off and
that's
go
all,
on.
That's all?
Pretty much, yeah.
They turn the whole thing around in 2 days.
Yeah, the bigger ships can take a little bit longer, yeah, but usually 2 to 3 days, yeah.
Incredible. You can imagine the logistics of remembering what container to pick up and put on the ship. I guess
A lot of the ports these days are controlled by essentially robots. So, yeah, it's all electronically manifested, and, yeah, so it's a pretty incredible system. Obviously, it has to do with the amount of stuff that goes in and out.
Yeah. Someone's texted in saying inventing the containers on a par with the invention of the wheel. In some ways, because it's made international trade the thing it is. Not all goods are shipped via containers. I mean, there are wheat, sugar, iron ore, coal, and all that doesn't get shipped in containers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But pretty much everything else does, doesn't it?
Yeah, pretty much. I would suggest, and I haven't looked at
not
this.
Liquid, not liquids, not gas, of course, and not all.
No, they do have liquid boxes nowadays where they're the same size as a shipping container, but you just fill the liquid in from the top.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Like a big esky.
Well, yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. How much does it cost to ship a container worth of goods? Well, actually, before we say that, I mean, I said that we're overwhelmingly dependent on this. I mean, it's more than 99%, I think, isn't it, of the stuff that comes into Australia comes by ship?
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah. How much does it cost to send a container, a box, say a 20-foot container? If I filled it up with, you know, some of my my wood carvings, for example, Jason, I wanted to send them somewhere.
Please don't talk about wood carvings when you're coming into Australia.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
You would have a field day.
That's right. You can't. Okay.
What the shipping lines run in a very weird format where they essentially change their pricing every 2 weeks depending on how much cargo they have currently booked.
Mm-hmm.
So it's incredibly difficult to maintain. So we've seen just in this year alone, a 20-foot container from China, we've seen the pricing go from about $800 to, at the moment they're getting up to, because we're coming into Christmas and obviously everything's got to be expensive for Christmas, coming up to about $2,300 per 20-foot container.
It's still not a lot of money, isn't it, considering how much stuff you can fit in there?
Yeah, I mean, but that's only one real part of it. You know, Australia in itself is obviously a very expensive country to operate in. So just to pick up a container from the port in Australia costs somewhere between, and this is not for transporting, this is just the infrastructure charges, port, internal port charges, and dehire charges, it's between $560 and $605.
So it costs nearly as much to pick it up from the port and take it to your warehouse as it did to ship it.
Well,
to ship.
That doesn't include the cartage. Then the cartage with fuel surcharges and tolls and everything can also be up around $1,000. So, yeah, the stuff that happens in Australia is quite often more than the whole shipping cost.
Wow. That's quite remarkable. All right. So when the ship gets unloaded, it puts the box on the wharf.
Yes.
And someone remembers where it is. Do they?
The robots, yes.
The robots remember where it is. So when the truck driver arrives at the gate, who tells him where the box is?
Okay. So when you pick up a container from the port, so once it's offloaded from the ship, the port gives you 3 days for free before they start charging you astonishing amounts of storage.
Okay.
And prior to the ship's arrival, you have to book a one-hour window to be able to pick your container up.
Uh-huh.
So in the background, the systems, what they call the autostrads at the port, so they're autonomous robot machines. And when you book a slot, say, I'm going to pick up this container at 10 o'clock on Tuesday, and it will go, okay, you pull into, you know, bay number 10. And so the autonomous robot crane machine will move it near bay number 10, and then you get in there at that time and it will find that container and it'll put it on you. Then you drive out, and it's just a continuous motion of moving the containers around. And it's such a great system.
Well, we're talking about the business of shipping. Jason Williams is our guest, international freight expert, director of Willship International. You might have some questions to ask too. 1-300-800-222 if there's something that's always puzzled you. We've just been talking about the remarkably cheap cost, in a way, less than $1,000 US. Or it could be double that, depending on how busy they are to ship a container from China to Australia. What about going back the other way? Same price?
Absolutely not. it is an incredibly cheap trade lane. Australia, a lot of our exported goods, as you said before, are not containerized.
Yeah.
So they need the containers back up in China. So essentially, to get a container back up to China, it is nearly free. Okay. So they'll give you a rate of US dollars 430, say, for a 20 or 40 foot container back up to China. But included in that is all your Australian landside charges and all of your documentation charges, which usually amount to about $800. Okay. So.
I must say when I'm looking at Costco, the Chinese shipping line container ships leaving an Australian port, presumably heading back to China at some point, I was thinking, looking at all the containers, I think, are they mostly empty? Because I'm not thinking we're sending...
A lot of them are empty. They every so often, I'm not sure how often these days, but they will do an empty sweep.
Okay.
They'll just come in and take the empties back up.
Yeah. How much does a container cost anyway? Who owns the container?
A lot of the shipping lines do own their own, but a lot of containers are also leased from various leasing companies around the world.
Mm-hmm.
A brand new 20 foot, probably about 3,000 US, and a brand new 40 foot, probably about 5,000 US, I would suggest.
Okay. How long do they last?
They need to be what they call certified, I think it's every 3 or 4 years from the time that they're new.
Yeah.
And it's how rough they're treated, I suppose. But, you know, I've seen containers still rolling around from early 2000s. And, yeah, as long as they're sea, wind and watertight, and they've got their CSC or surveyor approval, then they're right to go.
Mm. 99% of Australia's international trade by volume is carried by sea. It's a big deal for us, shipping. We're an island nation. Why don't we have our own shipping line, Jason? this is something people often ask.
We used to, Phil. Yeah. We used to have a shipping line called A&L.
Yeah, we did.
Which was Australian National Shipping. And A&L still lives, but it's owned by a French company called CMA CGM.
Why is it? I mean, what happened to it? So we can start to talk about who owns international shipping, I suppose. But you'd think an island nation like Australia, with you know, it's massive dependence on us, would have a natural advantage here. But we don't, do we?
No. Look, I think that we're so. It's hard to explain. I feel like when we talk about shipping to Australia, we're essentially that place on the other side of the world that is a bit of a pain for some lines.
Mm.
And I don't think that if you're just running between Australia and everywhere else in the world that you're going to be able to sustain a quality, profitable shipping line. I think
The empty containers that go back all the time.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, A&L was a good business, but it seems to me the whole business of international shipping is be eaten or eat. So all the biggest lines in the world seem to be buying out each other and gaining more and more ownership of the, of the whole shipping landscape.
Who are the biggest shipping lines in the world anyway? Are they Chinese these days? Costco is the one I see the most. But
yeah, Costco is Chinese. So CMA is one of the biggest.
Is that Chinese?
No, that's the French company that bought A&L.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. There is also MSC, which is Mediterranean Shipping Company. And I'm just – then Maersk Line is an absolute monster as well, and they're from Denmark.
Right.
So they – I did tell you at the start that I do get a little bit jaded in relation to the shipping line, so I just want to tell you a wonderful story about COVID, if that's okay.
Yeah, go on.
Okay. So during COVID, the shipping lines didn't, as no one did really, to be honest, they didn't have any foresight in relation to the global growth of online shopping.
Mm-hmm.
So they all thought that the shipping industry was going to go into hiatus, so they put a number of their vessels into anchorage and wound them down to sleep for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then the online shopping happened and it just blew international trade out of the water and they couldn't get enough ships mobilized in time. So in their wisdom, they decided to just increase shipping rates to anywhere they can and they'd just suit the courses that need it. So China to the US or China to Australia. So during COVID, a 20-foot container from China to Australia was US $6,000.
Oh, wow.
And US 12 for a 40-foot up to the US from China was about $25,000.
Wow.
So the shipping lines that they kept their other ships sleeping. So they essentially, some of them tripled or quadrupled their revenue with half the ships on the water in that, you know, 1 year process. Like literally went from making $1 billion to $50 billion a year. And, yeah, they certainly ran for it.
Well, Mark, this is a question that you wanted to raise. G'day, Mark.
Oh, g'day, yeah. I was just going to ask the same thing, was whether the shipping lines were actually what's the term, price gouging, yeah, during COVID.
And the answer is yes.
They were having an absolute party during COVID. It was horrible.
Yeah. It sounds very concentrated, Jason. Why is it so concentrated? Because, you know, the barriers to entry are not that great, are they?
To owning a shipping line,
to running a shipping line anyway.
The barrier to entry is it's pretty huge. To be fair with you, I have a bit of a story at the back end of COVID. One of my friends was as upset as all of us freight forwarders were about the absolute gouging that our customers were getting. You know, he's been in shipping probably the same time I have, but he's a lot more diverse than I have. He's been into chartering and mining and all of that stuff. So he had a great plan on him, and he was able to get funding and get everything sorted to get a shipping line up and running. And he essentially wanted to run a shipping line between Australia and New Zealand, offering great rates and excellent customer service. The big players in the market, so he went and got a number of customers and started really well. The big players in the market went to these customers and said, if you keep giving them containers, we're going to up your rates to all other parts of the globe. And then they slashed their rates to a point, you know, they've got hundreds of billions of dollars in their coffers. They can cop a $50 million hit over 6 months to get rid of a shipping line. So, yeah, over the next probably 6 to 8 weeks, they essentially just slashed the rates to the point where my mate's shipping line went belly up in about 6 or 7 months. And, yeah, investors lost about $15 million in time.
Well, because, I mean, yeah, my question was prompted by the fact that there are a lot more airlines in the world.
Yeah,
airlines are a dime a dozen. There's heaps of them. But there aren't that many shipping lines, are there?
No, not really. There used to be a lot more, but it just seems like there's the big conglomerates, and they all seem to be sharing space and doing what they're doing. And it to me, I've been in the industry so long, and I feel like they're not accountable to anyone or anything.
Yeah.
Mm.
1-300-800-222 is my number. Jason Williams is our guest tonight. We're talking about the business of shipping. If you've got questions, 1-300-800-222. Andrew from Atherton. G'day, Andrew.
Well, g'day, Phil. Jason, I was just wondering, given the incredible volume of sea freight and the time constraints to move it on once it's landed, how much interaction does customs actually have, because logistically it would be impossible to search every single container, unload it and reload it, and then send it to the customer. So how do they cope with that?
Mm.
That's a great question. Do you want me to grab Phil?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sorry.
you're the expert, Jason.
Yeah, no, sorry. So a lot of the times, so there is a rule that before any vessel arrives into Australia, a manifest is put into customs. And that manifest has to show the importer's full details in the ABN and who their supplier is. And the back end of the customs system was going, oh, they've imported from this company before and they do it this many times.
Right.
If they see that there is an anomaly in relation to the supplier and the importer, they will put a, let's say, an orange flag on it. And then what we do as well, we do a customs clearance, which it links up to that manifest, which is a high-level view of what's going into the country. And our customs entry lists every single thing that's inside that shipment using what they call a HS code, which is a worldwide harmonized code of numbers that, you know, tells everyone what everything is in the game. So if that doesn't line up, that orange flag goes to a red flag and customs will put what they call a processing hold on it, and they will do some investigation in the background, or they will X-ray the container. But if they use a lot of, you know, smart technology to go, yep, imports all the time from these five companies, it's always the same thing. We're going to have a look at every 10 of them.
Okay.
So there's a lot of the process in Australia is fully electronic. Like, if we've got all the documentation and everything is perfect, we can clear a shipment completely through customs within an hour and a half.
Because of the documentation.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if there's contraband, I import fridges, you know, 5,000 fridges a month.
Yeah. You're definitely going to be looked at.
Yeah. So at some point they will be looked at.
Yeah. At some point.
Even if I just do it, I'm doing it every month, 5,000 fridges. But at some point, you reckon the container will be opened and they'll have a look.
Yep. Oh, they usually X-ray them.
Okay.
Yeah, they run through an X-ray machine, and it happens a lot. They're getting a lot more.
How's a bloke supposed to run a gun running business then? In Jason, I mean,
yeah, very difficult actually. We still do get a lot of contraband coming into Australia. Let's talk about, you know, cocaine in Australia is so expensive that even if only 1 in 10 shipments get through, it's still profitable.
Mm.
So it's absolutely crazy. And we have seen, we've had a run-in with a number of, different people trying to bring in various different products. And, you just have to, if you get an inkling, it's part of our role that we need to reach out to the Border Force and go, hey, we think something's wrong here.
Oh, okay. But it's mainly done on what you're saying is mainly done on documentation.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, what we're seeing at the moment is a lot of, piggyback shipments where someone will use a legitimate company in their ABN but then have a mobile number and a Gmail account.
Okay.
So, we've seen that a lot lately, but customs is really kicking down on that.
Mm. Okay, so it's quite regulated then. I mean, in other words, if my, if I've got 5,000 fridges a month that I'm bringing in, if I decide to bring in, a collectible car 1 month instead of the fridges, that'd be an anomaly, wouldn't it?
Well, you've chosen an odd one, which is always an anomaly. So. We have a collectible car is a second-hand product, so that's going to be, unpacked and inspected anyway to ensure there's no quarantine risk material in it.
Okay.
But we also, in older cars now, you're not allowed to bring any asbestos into the country, so old gaskets and brake pads. So if you don't have a certificate from your supplier stating that all asbestos has been removed, then we've got to get someone in there to pull the wheels off it and check the brakes.
Okay, there's a massive workforce involved in all this, isn't there?
Well, customs don't do it. They just make other people do it.
They make other people do it, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's there's a lot of Australia has a lot of odd rules. So if you shipped a race car out to New Zealand for a year, so you shipped an old Holden out to New Zealand for a year and then you brought it back in, they'd be like, oh, hold on, I think that's got asbestos in it. They'll make you take the asbestos out, although it was in Australia.
Wow.
Yes.
1-300-800-222. I've heard a theory from someone who worked in clothes manufacturing that it costs more to be on the lower rank rows of containers on the ship, and that is inside the hold, than stacked on the top container on the deck at the back, for example, because in a storm, that's the first container that's going to tip off and go into the drink. Is that right?
It probably used to be right. And maybe showing my age, but in the early days, when you did what's called a receival advice for export, and you do it in everywhere around the world. And if your Chinese supplier goes, I think that's 5,000 kilos, then everyone deems that container weighs 5,000 kilos.
Yeah.
But what used to happen, exactly what you're saying, is you could have four containers down the bottom of the vessel that actually have clothing in them and three containers on top of them that have 25 tons of steel in them.
Yeah.
And if you hit rough seas, yes, things are going to go bad. So now they have a new rule around the whole world called SOLAS, which is Save Our Lives at Sea.
Right.
And every single container that gets carried on a vessel must have what's called a VGM or a verified gross mass. So every single container must be weighed. So the loading of the vessels is done in relation to the weights of the containers.
So you put the heavy stuff on the bottom.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Interesting. How much does it cost to go through the canals of the world? If you go into Europe, you go through the Suez Canal. How much does it cost to send a container ship through the Suez Canal?
Oh, my God, I knew this, but I can't remember at the moment. Bear with me. I could probably find it out.
But I'm suggesting it's probably a lot. Or maybe it's not.
Oh, no, I'm pretty sure it's crazy pricing. Okay. Somewhere between, depending on the size of the ship, 250,000 US to $1 million.
$1 million just to go through the canal.
Yeah, but I think it saves them a fortune. So standard, the smaller ships that come into Australia, the 10,000 container ones, not that small, even though they're pushing for fuel efficiency, they're still using about 220,000 litres of diesel a day. So that's a fair amount of fuel.
That's a huge amount of fuel.
Yeah.
What's happening with green fuel? Because, I mean, one of the big things about climate and the carbon reduction and so on has been industries like, you know, we've talked about steel and concrete, but in the transport business, heavy haulage, interstate transport, and shipping and aeroplanes. I mean, all the big transport links are highly carbon intensive, and something like shipping seems to be a particular problem. I mean, people have talked about hydrogen ships. I think Twiggy's got a green hydrogen ship, something floating around the world somewhere. How much progress has been made in that? How practical is it anyway?
It was really, really popular a few years ago, but it seems to have dropped off, I think, because of the incredible cost to get it in play. I think I'm not sure how far in the future, but I do believe that there will be a move to it. They've just got to find a power source that has the ability to have this incredible amount of low down torque and not just draw down on power so quickly. That's essentially the problem. But they have changed to a different form of diesel called low sulfur. And they charge the shipping lines charge a freight rate and then a low sulfur surcharge. So they're not being nice to anyone about it. But they're trying to do their bit, but I don't know, I feel worldwide inflation at the moment is running pretty hot and everyone wants everything as cheaply as they can. And while we're all demanding goods and demanding this and that, I think the shipping lines are you know, having a bit of a free-for-all and making as much money as they can without investing in the future.
Mm. Just back on ownership, because years ago, I mean, the last time I thought about it at any length, Jason, I remember the Greeks owned all the world shipping, but that's changed, has it?
Yeah. How long ago was that?
I'm thinking back in the 60s and 70s probably, so 50 years ago.
Yeah, there was when I started, there were a few Greek lines, but, yeah, it just seems that all the – you know, there's the recent ones are Hapag-Lloyd got bought out by Maersk Line and, like, they were both massive shipping lines. And in the industry, we call Maersk Line the Death Star. You just never get to talk to a person and it's like all decisions are made by a computer.
Another sort of urban myth about transport is that I suppose that shipping – ships are so big these days and the unit cost of something that's shipped internationally is extremely small, almost negligible. Well, it can't be negligible because that wouldn't make sense. But the unit cost attributable to shipping for, say, the fridge, to keep harping on about the fridge, just one individual fridge, is probably not that great, is it?
No, but I guess the fridge is a... because it's such a big item.
Yeah.
But if you think about a product, let's say, I don't know, a pair of shoes, you might fit 10,000 pairs of shoes in a shipping container that costs $5,000 to bring in.
Another $5,000 to you know, collect and take to your warehouse.
True, yeah. But essentially, I was including that then. Oh, okay. Essentially $2 a shoe for the whole process. But I think what happens in business, people go, oh, wow, I can buy this for this. Yeah. I'm going to make this much money. And then they speak to a freight forwarder and they go, I hate freight forwarders. we're going to dig into their profit. So, it's odd. Freight forwarders can be dropped and picked up for $20 a container, where in reality it makes like 1 cent of difference to the cost of goods.
Yeah. Freight forwarders are people who basically pick up your box and deal with it and get it to your warehouse, are they?
We're like travel agents for people's cargo is the way we like to look at it.
Okay.
So we work with we have deals, but we have accounts and contacts with every single one of the shipping lines, and our customers will go, hey, Jason, I've got a container of goods ready in Qingdao. Can you give me a price and a sailing? And we'll go back and go, okay, it's going to be this much money. Here's a sailing. Great, book it in. So then we book in the container. We speak to their supplier. We look after the loading of the container with their supplier, get all the documents in order, update our customer of when it's loaded and when it's leaving China, handle all the documentation, do the customs clearance as it's arriving to Australia, get the container off the port, either yeah. deliver it directly to our customer or unpack it. So we essentially do, we put all the bits together. So a shipping line will ship it, a transport company will truck it, a customs broker will clear it, but a freight forwarder will do all of the little bits in between.
Lots of people nibbling, hey, at all stages of the process.
Yeah, to a degree, but I think if essentially we call, and it sounds odd, we call ourselves a one-stop shop, but in reality, we're essentially communicating. We're communicating from our customer to the shipping lines, from our customer to the transport companies, back to our customer. And, we don't actually control anything, so it can become controlling as a freight forwarder. You know, if you've got a vessel that gets delayed, your customer's like, well, what we want our goods. Can you make the vessel come in sooner? So, we're like, yeah, okay, we'll just ring the captain and get him to rock on in.
Put his foot on the pedal. Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Put his foot on the big lever and go forward. Jason Williams is with us. He's an international freight expert and director at Willship. We're talking about international shipping. What happens if a ship sinks, Jason? This all just becomes an insurance nightmare then, does it? Let's assume the crew are all off safely.
Okay, that's good. My biggest thing would be the first answer to that is insurance.
Yeah.
So when a ship is at sea, they have a thing called the general average. Have you ever heard of that before?
No.
Okay, so the ship is where it is because your cargo's on it.
Yeah.
So if that ship runs aground and it costs $50 million to get the ship off where it is, then every single person on that vessel has to pay their share of that $50 million. So if the ship sinks, you pay the cost of...
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's crazy. So my
container of cheap runners from China, I've not only lost my container, I also have to pay for the ship.
Absolutely, yeah, but it's amortized on the value of the goods. So say you've got a container of pillows worth $1,000 and the guy next door has a container of gold, he's going to be paying a lot more. So it's amortized on a value over the cost of all the goods on the ship, and everyone on the ship has to pay their share.
Uh-huh.
And if you are not insured, I've had this before, the shipping line hits you with a bill, and if you can't pay the bill, then they take ownership of your goods. If they don't lose them.
If they don't lose them. You know, how sometimes containers wash up on shores?
Mm.
Who owns that? Who owns the container in that circumstance?
That's a great question. To be honest, my answer is I don't know.
Right.
If a lot of most shipping containers are labeled with, every container has a container number, which is usually four letters and I think six or seven digits.
Yeah.
And based on those, you can work out whose container it is or who owns it.
Hmm.
If they've lost it at sea, but it'd be a pretty big task to move it off the beach and go unnoticed. So.
Yes, that's true. Sandy says, stop using Temu. Yes, fair enough, Sandy. Actually, Jason probably doesn't want to hear you saying that.
No, it's one of those things, and it's something I'd really like to touch on. It's something we find a lot in our business. We're seeing a lot of people buying products from Temu, but that's a much smaller program, but... people buying a lot of products from Alibaba.
Right. This is a big online Chinese shopping site.
Yeah, and people are buying outdoor saunas and spas and food vans and all of these different things, and the suppliers going, great, we can ship it to you for US $500.
I know. I was looking the other night just idly and someone was trying to sell me an excavator.
Yeah.
Like a massive big piece of machinery. But, yeah, you know, go, but that was alongside a pair of cheap runners. I mean, you could buy an excavator.
But they will go, yeah, we can ship it to you for $600.
Yeah.
And we get customers reach out to us and go, oh, my excavator's or my sauna's about to show up. Can you deliver it to me? And I go, has anyone contacted you in Australia?
Yeah.
No. I'm like, well, that cost is just to the port, and then you're going to get all these extra charges, and then this is going to happen, and this is going to happen, and you're probably going to have to spend another few $1,000s to get off the port and cleared. And they go, what? I had no idea.
Huh.
So I feel like and we're getting this a lot, like maybe 3 to 4 times a week in our business. We have to explain to people, and they go, oh my God. Yeah, there's just a lot of misinformation coming from the Chinese, but I don't think they're doing it on purpose. I don't think they understand what happens in Australia.
Yeah, that's right. As far as they're concerned, it's cheap to get it on the container in the ship, and they'd wave goodbye at the dock, but that's it.
Yeah, see you later.
Yeah. Are Australian ports efficient or not?
No.
Right. In short, okay.
Yeah.
As compared to what?
Look, the Chinese ports are insane. I think Melbourne does about 3.2 million containers a year.
Yeah.
Only one of the ports in Shanghai does about 50 million.
One port.
There's two in Shanghai, and one of them does 50 million a year. And our costs is obviously our port workers. Not that there's that many of them anymore, but they're paid incredibly well.
Yeah, but labour costs in a port these days are probably not a big deal, though, are they? Given the degree of mechanisation you're talking about, it's all capital. Yeah. It's all capital investment. It's all capital work. It's robot cranes.
Once the capital gets paid for, but I guess it's the first round of the autonomous machines. No one's really sure how long they're going to last for, but yeah, there is a massive labour saving that the ports will be seeing at the moment.
Mm. What about if a pirate knocks, apprehends his ship? I mean, this has happened, isn't it, off the coast of Africa? Seems to happen on a reasonably regular basis.
It has been happening a bit with the Somalians lately.
Yeah. What happens in those circumstances?
Again, it depends on the actual outcome. If containers are lost and there's damage incurred to the vessel, it's only there because your cargo's on it, so they'd call a general average.
Yep.
What's really happening at the moment is the shipping lines are not going that way. So they're obviously looking at these situations, and so they won't go around Africa to go past the pirates anymore. So they'll go on a longer version. I'm just trying to remember where they're going at the moment.
They'll to pick a different sea route. Just before we go, look at when you're talking about it, it's interesting, fun stuff. Time disappears on us. Just before you go, Jason, how we often talk about, the government talks about, because of the international security situation, the fragility of Australia's shipping channels and so on, the submarines which are coming on the Never Never at some point in the far distant future are supposed to be protecting these shipping lanes. But in a sense, given the highly concentrated nature of the ownership of international shipping, then presumably it is fragile, isn't it? Or not?
I don't know. I feel like it's not fragile in a sense that the shipping lines are making an obscene amount of money. And they have the worldwide market sewn up to a point that if you wanted to get into the market, you would need a couple of billion dollars to even be someone that they would be scared of. So can you take a shipping line down? Can a shipping line go bankrupt? I think their wallets are too full from the last few years of trading, and I think that COVID taught them that they can manipulate trade lanes and they can manipulate rates, and then they essentially they don't really answer to any government. And it just seems that if one falls off, then another one will take its spot in that trade lane. So I don't think it's fragile. I don't like the fact that there's owned by a small conglomerate, though.
Are Donald Trump's tariffs going to impact the whole business? Will there be less shipping?
They haven't affected us at all. I had a coffee with a shipping line recently, and they move a lot of vehicles. They're a roll-on, roll-off carrier. They move a lot of vehicles from Europe to the USA.
Yeah.
They were absolutely crapping their pants. Like, they were looking at overhauling their worldwide program. But for us as our business, after that conversation, I'm like, yes, now we're going to get cheaper freight rates from China into Australia on all this
That's what I was thinking, yeah.
Yeah, European cars coming into Australia really cheaply, and then we're going to set up free trade. I was quite excited, but it hasn't really happened. The weirdest thing is with what Trump is doing is I'm going to have a bit of a rant here really quickly, but
it has to be quick.
So we have a free trade agreement with the USA, a unilateral free trade agreement.
Doesn't seem to mean much anymore, but go on.
No, he just changed his mind in one day. So that is one thing, but he's trying to, rebuild industry in the States by putting tariffs on everything, but he doesn't get the fact that rebuilding an industry takes a lot of time. And a lot of tooling that will probably come from overseas that he's already put tariffs on.
So he's
setting, and the tariffs are paid by the people in the US, not by the supplier.
That's right.
So it's the idea of it is great, but you've got to look at a 5 or 10 year plan about how to.
You know what? It's not a new idea, and you know what? It's been tried before, and you know what? It didn't work. that's a plain fact of economic history.
Yeah.
Crazy. All right. We've run out of time, Jason, which is a pity because actually, maybe you and I should retire to the back bar. We'll keep talking about it. Thanks very much for your time and expertise. It's been so interesting. I don't think people realise where stuff comes from and how complicated it is. Jason Williams has been our guest. He's an international freight expert. He's the director of Willship International, and he's been generous with his time tonight. Thanks, Jason.
Awesome, mate. Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.